It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The introduction of fentanyl into the street drug supply has made it almost impossible for opioid users to know what they're taking.
The Drug Enforcement Administration says that last year it seized more than 80 million counterfeit pills made to look like a real prescription, but that contain an unknown, unregulated amount of fentanyl, which can take just 2 milligrams to kill someone.
In Wisconsin, it was one of these pills that killed a Brown County youth, and it was purchased from another teenager in that county who has since been charged with homicide.
A new ProPublica report tells their story and digs into ways that the legal and healthcare systems are falling short for teens when it comes to opioids. Lizzie Presser is a reporter at ProPublica covering health and healthcare policy. Her article is called Malia and Jack, A Story of Teens and Fentanyl. Lizzie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Can you briefly tell us about, first of all, Jack McDonough, who sadly dies after dealing with addiction and these fentanyl pills showing up at schools?
Of course. So Jack McDonough grew up in De Pere, Wisconsin, just outside of Green Bay. He grew up with his mother and was doing pretty well as a kid at school. He went to Southwest High School in Green Bay. He struggled academically and had low self-esteem, but otherwise had a great group of friends. He didn't do drugs. He smoked weed occasionally. And at the age of 17, he was introduced to Percocets, is what they were called at the time. And he learned to smoke them off of tinfoil. He soon learned that instead of Percocet, he was actually smoking fentanyl. But by that time, he was addicted. So within a couple of months, he really needed one a day or else he was going to be sick. And his mom caught on. She got a sense of what was going on. She saw him rapidly losing weight. She saw ash marks in her car. She saw pieces of tinfoil around the house or straws. She didn't know these were signs of a counterfeit pill problem, but she knew something was up and she looked for help and was really struggling to find it at school and in the community. Eventually, she found out that her son was smoking so-called Percocets and got him into a rehab. But even the rehab wasn't able to help him. They didn't test his urine for fentanyl, and they didn't offer him the first-line treatment that's recommended for teenagers with an opioid use disorder called buprenorphine. It's a long-acting opioid that will protect against overdose and pull back cravings and withdrawal symptoms. So Jack returned to Green Bay at the age of 18, and logged into his girlfriend's Facebook and bought a pill from Malia Sotelo, a 15-year-old who was selling pills at the time. It was the first time he had bought from her. He bought a single pill. He went back to his grandparents where he was living. He smoked that pill, and the following morning, he had died.
And Malia, who he had bought that pill from at 15, selling these illegal counterfeit drugs, tell us her story and how that ended up converging.
Malia grew up the fourth of five sisters with a single mother who had an opioid addiction. In some ways, she was also a child of the opioid crisis. Her mom was unable to parent well. She had serious mental health issues that were going untreated. She turned their home into a kind of trap house where users and dealers were coming by all the time. So Malia grew up around drugs and around the business of drugs. When her mom was no longer fit to parent, one of her older sisters took her in, and her older sister, Mariana, had found that selling drugs was a way to support herself when her mother couldn't. And so Mariana was selling weed, and then she was selling so-called Percocets. So at the age of 15, Malia was exposed to this lifestyle. And once Mariana was arrested and federally indicted for dealing in fentanyl-laced Percocets, her clients started calling Malia asking where they could buy these pills. And Malia saw an opportunity to make some money for her and her younger sister, who she was really charged with taking care of. And she began to sell these fentanyl-laced pills. When I say fentanyl-laced pills, I think it's a bit of a misnomer.
Right.
These aren't fentanyl-laced pills. These pills are just fentanyl and filler. There is no oxycodone or acetaminophen in them. She was selling for several months and making very good money. And after a while, the drug task force caught on They did a controlled buy. They confirmed that she was selling fentanyl, and they did not arrest her. They decided they would wait to build a case. And 3 days later, she sold a pill to Jack, and Jack overdosed and died. Emilio was then charged with homicide.
We were talking about Wisconsin teens, the opioid crisis, and fentanyl pills with Lizzie Presser, health and healthcare policy reporter at ProPublica. You go much deeper into their stories in your piece. But a theme that comes out again and again, Lizzie, is so many points where different systems failed both of these teens. And I want to start with that one that you just mentioned, that Jack's mom really was focused on. The idea that, okay, law enforcement knew that she was selling these fentanyl pills, not fentanyl laced, as you say, but fentanyl pills, and didn't move in and arrest her at the time. Can you talk about that decision and what went into it?
I think there are two parts of this that we need to kind of break apart. The first is that it really is the bread and butter of these proactive narcotics investigations to build a case against someone. So to bring in a controlled and an informant, or for a police officer to go undercover themselves, to make a buy, and then to see if you can surveil and see that this is a habit, not a single purchase, right? So that has long been the process by which these cops operate. When it comes to fentanyl, it doesn't seem as if there has been much reckoning with that process when we know that we are dealing with a far more lethal drug than we have in the past 20 years. So that's one question. Why are we, as a society, not questioning these practices when police are finding folks who are selling what they deem a poison on the street and not doing anything about it? Surely if they found a kid with a gun they shouldn't have had, they would arrest that child immediately and not wait to build a bigger case, right? So that's, I think, the first part of this. The second is that Melia was 15 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a misconception in this country that we think about kids differently from adults. In the legal system, when in fact, in many parts of the judicial system, we do not. So sure, in sentencing, we have seen major reform when it comes to children, because the Supreme Court has ruled again and again that children are not little adults. They don't understand what they're doing in the same way. They can't compute consequences in the same way. And that has all been decided based on a large and growing body of evidence on brain science and neurology. This is not being absorbed by law enforcement. And so what we are finding with the Brown County Drug Task Force, but truly with police forces across the country, is very little policy around what to do when you encounter a minor who is a suspect, how to treat them differently from how you might treat an adult.
Another failure goes way back further with Melia. You talked about her background growing up in a drug household, basically various points of intervention where child services and other agencies might have come in contact, never anything that would have steered her in another path. Can you talk about that a little?
This is a pretty disturbing finding because over the course of Melia's childhood, there were at least 20 referrals to Child Protective Services that were referencing drug use, neglect, no food in the house, sexual abuse to the kids, physical abuse. And over again, Child Protective Services closed the cases. And this was in large part because their mother just refused to participate. And according to Wisconsin statute, you can't identify a mistreater, a maltreater in the Child Protective Services system unless you can interview that person or find a police report. But because Melia's mother refused to participate, they had nowhere to go with the cases, and they closed case after case. So Melia and her sisters were left living with a very dangerous mother for most of their childhoods.
Then on Jack's side, his mother, Carrie, as you said, recognized the problem. At some points, Jack even recognized the problem. You share a heartbreaking letter that Jack writes to his mom. Services very hard for his mom, Carrie, to find when he finds them, as you said, not really giving him the tools he need. What was missing?
Well, first off, very few doctors around the country and in Wisconsin provide buprenorphine, this drug that I've mentioned, which is the first line recommended treatment for teenagers with an opioid use disorder, to minors. There's a major lag in our country's ability to ramp up these services for teens, given how rapidly fentanyl has entered the drug supply. But on top of that, if you look more specifically at just outpatient or inpatient rehabilitation centers, they just don't exist for kids like Jack. So Carrie called SAMHSA, the most comprehensive national resource hotline in the country. It's the federal hotline that's supposed to point you to where to go. And they pointed her to an organization, Libertas, in Brown County, whose inpatient services for teens were actually closed and who didn't provide the gold standard treatment for teenagers. She ended up finding a rehab in Minnesota, and she was only lucky enough to do that because she could afford to pay out of pocket $1,000 a week for 4 weeks. Most people can't do that. And even there, which this is one of 39 rehabs in this country that offer buprenorphine to kids. It's a tiny, tiny fraction. And even there, they didn't give Jack the care that he needed, the treatment that he needed. And he returned to Green Bay, still dependent and addicted to fentanyl. On top of all of this, there was the school. And Carrie kept turning to the school and asking for help. And she says she was brushed off. And these schools are under-resourced, right? They don't have the funding and the ability and even the referral pathways for these kids. But that's the first place that a lot of parents are going to go, and those schools aren't helping these parents.
Just briefly in our last half a minute, Lizzie, why was it important to you to put a face on what we might just see statistics about?
I think ultimately this is exactly what you were saying. It is a story about how unwilling as a society we have been to look directly at addiction, and particularly when it comes to minors. We hear lots of stories of kids dying spontaneously from a fentanyl-laced pill, which suggests that this is a rare exposure to fentanyl. In my reporting, I found something quite different. There are hundreds of thousands of kids who are addicted to opioids and are struggling to find the treatment that they need. They want the treatment. Their parents want the treatment. But we as a country have not built the infrastructure to supply those kinds of services to these kids. And that's something that we're ignoring and need to be paying attention to.
Lizzie, thanks for sharing your work with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Lizzie Presser, reporter at ProPublica. She covers health and healthcare policy. Her story about a Wisconsin teen who passed away because of fentanyl and the person who sold it to him. It's called Malia and Jack, a story of teens and fentanyl. Find it at ProPublica.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, dozens of Wisconsinites are on the ground in Florida helping in relief efforts after two devastating hurricanes.
We are getting ready with this climate change to be in continuous disaster mode, and we need a lot of volunteers.
We meet American Red Cross of Wisconsin volunteers on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republican Eric Hovde leaned heavily on his business acumen when he first ran for U.S. Senate more than a decade ago.
This year, as he campaigns against Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, he's again worn it on his sleeve. But as Rich Kramer reports, the political circumstances are different this time.
As he toured a cranberry farm in Tomah last month, Eric Hovde peppered owner Bill Bossard and his wife Diane with questions, from how their crops have handled this year's rainfall to whether they buy their own bees to pollinate plants. And when Hovde heard the couple and their kids go to work washing and packaging millions of pounds of cranberries each fall, he perked up.
That's a family business.
It is, yeah.
That's impressive.
I don't know if my kids are that excited about it, but they will show up.
Hovde's background in business is a big part of his political brand. He and his family built a real estate and financial services business into a conglomeration of companies with a national reach, including a chain of banks in California. Along the way, he's racked up a net worth of between $195 and $560 million, according to a July financial disclosure. Bossart says he sees similarities between himself and Hovde. Both understand the challenges of growing businesses, and he's keenly aware of the importance of Hovde's Senate race.
This is when the Senate race is going to decide who's in charge for the next 2 years.
Hovde's message throughout the campaign is that Washington, D.C. needs more economic competency and fewer career politicians, a term he frequently uses to describe Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. Baldwin is widely regarded as a formidable candidate, but over the last month, polls have shown the gulf between the two shrinking. Hovde says momentum is on his side.
Look, I think I'm resonating because I'm talking about issues that matter to them, and
I'm out there every day speaking to Wisconsin voters, and what do I hear their concerns? Inflation, the price of their food, the price of gasoline, housing, access to housing, the cost of housing.
Unlike his unsuccessful 2012 run for Senate, Hovde didn't face a bruising Republican primary this year. But the Cook Political Report's Jessica Taylor says she heard a lot of grumbles from Republicans about his campaign focusing too much on himself early on.
I think they wanted to see sort of a more disciplined campaign and a campaign that was more focused on Baldwin.
Instead, she says Hovde had a tendency of taking to social media to respond to Democratic attack ads featuring comments he's made. Those include when he said in 2012 that he was totally opposed to abortion, or this year when he said most nursing home residents are not at a point to vote. Taylor says that allowed Baldwin to define the race. More recently, Hovde's campaign has launched ads attacking Baldwin as a radical liberal. Taylor says she thinks the race is tightening. Longtime Wisconsin Republican strategist Bill McCaution says beating Baldwin will be no easy task.
Let's be honest, it's very hard to beat an incumbent United States senator.
He says Hovde has run a fairly strong campaign, but polling data underscores a trend he needs to reverse. A small percentage of Republicans who support former President Donald Trump also support Baldwin.
Whether it's 4 or 5%, it's still enough in a close race to be the difference. So Hovde can't have that. He has to have every single Trump supporter on his side in order to win.
McCaution says early in the campaign, it was debatable whether Trump would help or hurt Hovde. Now he says he needs to embrace the former president. At a rally in Juneau, Trump invited Hovde to the stage during his speech. Hovde used the moment to call on Republicans to get everyone they know to turn out in November.
And let's restore this great country and get President Trump and me to Washington. Let's go, folks!
A Hovde victory over Baldwin would be viewed as an upset and would dramatically hurt Democrats' chances of holding the Senate. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
Coastal communities in Florida are experiencing one of the most destructive hurricanes on record as Hurricane Milton made landfall as a Category 3 storm last night.
Milton is the second massive storm in recent weeks to hit Florida, with other parts of the state just starting to recover from Hurricane Helene. That storm also tore through Georgia and the Carolinas.
Amid the devastation, Wisconsinites have been stepping up to help. The American Red Cross of Wisconsin has sent more than 40 volunteers to the storm-ravaged states, providing emergency response and support to victims.
We talked to two of those volunteers on Tuesday afternoon before Milton made landfall.
Lil Duty is a retired emergency room nurse. Dave Nelson is a retired healthcare executive from Eau Claire. Dave starts by describing what his days are like on the ground in Tallahassee.
Well, my duties, I work primarily in the what we call disaster response headquarters. My duty is as a government operations liaison is to work with our Red Cross volunteers that are trained in emergency management. And they are actually, we have them placed in the emergency operations centers of most of the counties in Florida. And right now we've got 51 counties that are under the watch and warning for Milton. And so we're trying to staff those folks. And what those liaisons do for us is they're working with the local sheriffs, the emergency manager, of course, and the fire departments and all the local officials as to what the Red Cross needs to provide to support those communities, whether it be a shelter, was there a feeding need, or what kind of disaster supplies. They relate that information back up to me at headquarters where we vet it, make sure that that's all correct, get the right addresses, where's the delivery, where do they want this. And then I move that over to our operations staff. So those are our professionals in sheltering, feeding, and logistics for them to then go and set those items up. So I'm kind of that liaison that helps coordinate all those services that will go out into the different counties to provide what, as we call it, provide hope, for all the folks that are going to be affected or have been affected by the disaster.
So vital to have that clear communication in place on the needs, on the logistics. Lil, you volunteered at a shelter in Tallahassee for 10 days. What is the mental health toll on the people you've been working with in Florida?
Well, a lot of them are very stressed. What my job is as a disaster health services nurse, I was deployed to Tallahassee pre-landfall, so we had to wait out the storm, sat out the hurricane Helene that came in, and then we were sent out to the shelters to make sure that they were operating effectively and efficiently and providing services to the clients. They're just, some of them were, each one was very different. All the majority of the shelter residents are very stressed. They've gone through a horrendous experience. Some of them have escaped with their lives. They never expected the waters to rise so quickly. They had never experienced that before. Many of them lived in their homes for years. And they knew it was a hurricane, but they'd gone through them before. And they said, some of them said that we were in our house, and the next thing you know, we were at water up to our chest. The surge came in very quickly, and the people on this beautiful golf beaches on the Western Gulf, I mean, they've just lost everything. Many of them escaped with basically the clothes on their back if they didn't evacuate. They left behind their cell phones, which meant they had no communication with their families or their friends, because everybody knows a life is in the cell phone. Your numbers, yeah. You just don't know all that stuff anymore. So it was, and that's part of what we do as the Red Cross, is we provide their basic emergency needs, but we also listen to their stories. We try to help them sort through what they've gone through and that experience, and try to help them, so eventually they'll be able to move forward and recover.
We are talking with two Wisconsin volunteers helping to respond to the destruction of hurricanes in the southeast. Lil Duty and Dave Nelson are volunteers with the American Red Cross. Dave, there's been reporting in the New York Times that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is facing severe staffing shortages, with responding to these disasters. Fewer than 10% of FEMA disaster workers are available to respond to Milton. Is this putting greater strain on organizations like the American Red Cross?
I would have to say yes. And it's a result of a couple of things. Not only have we never experienced two major hurricanes this close together, and in fact, Milton's strengthening up to be probably of historic proportions to hit Florida like it's never been hit before. And since COVID, so this is important, I think since the COVID epidemic, we lost a lot of volunteers. And I think FEMA lost folks because as people were couldn't connect with others. And we are also in the process of rebuilding the organization, looking for more volunteers to come help and rejoin the Red Cross to provide these services. And when you look at Helene, that has affected not only Florida, but it's gone all the way up to Georgia. It's affected Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina. It was such a destructive hurricane. And you saw where it hit Florida, but North Carolina got hit almost worse than what happened in Florida. Mm. And so we're stretching our volunteers all across this section. And that doesn't even count the disasters that we're working on with the wildfires out in California and other parts of the U.S. One of the focuses that we do with the Red Cross right now, and part of our training, is we are getting ready with this climate change to be in continuous disaster mode. And we need a lot of volunteers to really help and bring hope to the folks that are being affected by some of these disasters.
Lil, when there are, as Dave says, at least six states reeling from major storm damage, how can volunteers be most effective when the destruction area is so large?
Well, the volunteers, they're ready. The Red Cross volunteers are very passionate about what they do. They're humanitarian. They believe in the Red Cross. They're ready to go over and above and extend themselves. You know, they go for 14 days, three-week deployments. Some of them go home for a week, and they ask to redeploy and go back. And but we need to keep bringing new volunteers in to help us, because a lot of our volunteers are older. They're retirees. We just need more volunteers. We need to replenish those that we lost during COVID, and some of them that age out and they don't deploy anymore because of their health issues. But there's still so many opportunities to volunteer at home.
Lil, you went from helping people who are displaced from Hurricane Helene to preparing your own home and your own family for Milton. How are you bracing for what some are calling the strongest storm in a century?
Well, we're just doing what we tell people to do with emergency preparedness. You know, we're going. We filled our car with gas. We're charging our phones. We're charging our chargers. We've got our bathtub filled with water. We're filling containers with water. We're really preparing in Central Florida. We're preparing for massive power outages. And this could go on for days. Buying perishable, non-perishable food so we'll have food to eat. Planning our safe room. A safe room is a room in your home that is not has doesn't have windows. It's maybe the strongest part of the house, which could be the bathroom. It could be the laundry room. Just planning all this, just thinking ahead, getting your go bag ready, making sure you have your cell phone just in case you do at the last minute have to evacuate. It's just, you're thinking of all these things. I mean, it's come from coming pre-landfall in Tallahassee for Helene to now getting ready for Milton. It's like I'm doing the same thing, but now I'm doing it for me personally and my family, and I'm not doing it for the volunteers or the people who have been affected. It's, you're doing the same thing, but doing it on a smaller scale. But it's a little scary because this is probably the fourth hurricane that I've actually been through. And I think this is probably potentially going to be the worst, the strongest.
Dave, the emotional toll on the volunteers who see the destruction up close, maybe feeling guilty for not losing their life or part of their home. What would you say there?
I don't think we feel guilty about any of it. I think a lot of us feel fortunate that we can be here to help those. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of this is, and this is kind of a personal thing for me, you know, why do I do Red Cross work? I have a strong belief in what the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Who knows, the day may come that I'm up in Wisconsin and we're drowning in water and I need volunteers from the Red Cross to come help us out. It's a national organization, and the volunteers that come to these responses and see the destruction, it's hard on us and you get very tired, but you know what? We go at this with a smile on our face to bring that hope, to help cheer these people up and try to get them back on their feet. And one of the other things I just would like to mention is that we just Lil mentioned and we talked about the need for volunteers and rebuilding. And some of the things is people think, oh, well, if I become a volunteer, I got to go on all these national responses. That's not true. We have volunteers that stay local. We have to be able to respond to house fires in every community, even by your house. If you're still working and you can't get away from your job, if you're what we call a DAT volunteer, you can respond to a house fire and help people that are affected just in your own community. Mm-hmm. You don't have to travel out of the state. We have lots of opportunities, different jobs for folks that can help out. And that's one of the things I like about the Red Cross is lots of options, because like today I'm delivering and doing logistics. Normally I do liaison work. I was doing a shelter managing job when I had pre-landfall to Helene in Jacksonville at the time. So you can do a lot of different things.
Lil, what is on your mind about that? How can people hearing this in Wisconsin be of help?
They can contact their local Red Cross office. They can look it up online. and tell them there's the website has usually has places says I'd like to volunteer, and you don't have you they take the Red Cross has people from all backgrounds. You don't have to have any specialty. You don't have to be, you know, someone who's geared into emergency. There's just so many other things. We do service to the armed forces. We do fire calls. We do local stuff. We do fire alarm installations. There is just a whole cadre of things that the Red Cross volunteers can take training and be able to do. I mean, classes for kids. Teaching first aid, doing pillows with Pedro, you know, where you teach kids how to pack and put things in a pillowcase for disaster response. There's just so many opportunities. It's making phone calls, maybe doing well-being checks on people. You don't have to have any special training to become a Red Cross volunteer. The Red Cross will give you classes and teach you how to do the job that you decide you want to do.
Well, Lil and Dave, I hope you can both stay safe, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, and thank you, too. It's been really a pleasure talking with you.
That is Dave Nelson, a retired healthcare executive from Eau Claire, and Lil Duty, a retired emergency room nurse. We spoke Tuesday afternoon about their volunteer work for the American Red Cross of Wisconsin. They are on the ground in Florida helping people who have been impacted by Hurricanes Milton and Helene. To learn more and find ways to help, go to redcross.org.
Up, take a road trip through scenic Wisconsin farmland with artwork and performances along the way.
The arts are a key ingredient to a thriving rural community.
It's the Farm Art Detour in Sauk County coming up on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Every year since 2011, the Worm Farm Institute, based in Reedsburg, has put on the Fermentation Fest and or the Farm Art Detour. They call it a culture convergence that brings together the worlds of farming, local food, and art.
Last year, Fermentation Fest included a lineup of classes about local Wisconsin ingredients like elderberries, sourdough, kernza, and mushrooms.
This year, the Farm Art Detour is taking center stage. It's a self-guided tour along 50 miles of farmland in the Driftless region with poetry, live performances, and art installations along the way.
Earlier this week, Wisconsin Today producer Rochelle Wilson drove out to Sauk County to check out the Farm Art Detour.
It's a sunny afternoon on the second day of the Farm Art Detour. I'm driving through the rolling farmlands of Sauk County to explore the detour's 50-mile loop, featuring art installations, live performances, and local food. I pull over to see the artwork at Stop 35. What's your name?
Audie.
And Audie, what are we seeing here right now?
I think it's a dragon made out of hay.
My name is Lauren.
Where are you here from?
Middleton, Wisconsin.
Can you describe this installation that we're at right now?
Sure. This is an irrigation system for the fields. And you can tell that when you look at the end of the dragon. But whoever did this is just a total... What I love is the creativity of melding art with farm equipment. And there's an installation up the road with hay rakes, and they built a wooden piece of art that looks like a hay rake, and it just all blends together. It's just wonderful. It's a really, really cool way for this part of the state to promote farming and art.
About midway through the tour, there's a site for vendors and performances called the Food Chain, held at Whitwind Park, an old church campground outside Sauk City. Here, I get a chance to catch up with some of the farmers selling food and other products at the festival. Mindy Clem with Four Elements Organic Herbals is selling products like essential oils and tea. She thinks the Driftless is a special area that draws people in from all over the region.
I think that's what makes this place super special and why people flock to these areas, because it's unique, this tour is unique, and this area is just beloved by so many also enthusiasts that want to take care of the land like we do.
Nearby, Dina Eagles and Deb Hilt with Echo Valley Farm have already sold out of everything besides apple cider and hot sauce. They'll be back next week with a full supply of baked goods, pickles, and more. They say what makes this event special is the people they get to meet.
It's so important that people get out of the city, you know, and taste nature and experience nature. People need that. It's a healing, really.
I see you nodding along.
Yeah, there's just nothing quite like living in the country and being so close to both the earth and the sky. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
After watching a Shadowbox puppet show in the Whitwind Barn, I meet artist Catherine Schwalbe. She participated in the first Farm Art Detour in 2011 and is back this year with an installation at Yadaki Granary, which survived a tornado in the area in 1870.
I think art is for everyone, and to have it be accessible without having to walk into a white wall space, those are opportunities I seek, because I really do feel it is for everyone to view and for everybody to do.
Catherine tells me about the Hayrake Ballet that took place earlier in the day, a choreographed dance featuring tractors, hayrakes, and local performers, including farmers.
And the hayrake dance was beyond just unforgettable works that make you think about a place differently for the rest of your life when you look at those places. Those works that were installed that are no longer there, that really still exist in your mind. It's beautiful. The cultural mashups of all the humans that come here, from the pumpkin grower across the street, about a mile down, and I never met him until yesterday, and we went to pick up pumpkins for display, and he puffed up and he said, "I'm going to be one of the tractor drivers in the ballet." And I'm like, ballet will never be the same. And so it's those bridges of humans that make it all worthwhile. Yeah.
Rochelle Wilson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Earlier this week, I talked about the history of the Farm Art Detour and what visitors can expect to see with Donna Newworth, co-founder and director of the Worm Farm Institute. She developed Fermentation Fest and has served as the artistic director of the Farm Art Detour since it opened in 2011. Donna, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Happy to be here.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about the Worm Farm Institute?
Well, we are a nonprofit organization based in Reedsburg, Wisconsin, and we work at the intersection of culture and agriculture. We have public-facing programs such as the Farm Art Detour, but we have also had an artist residency program on a working farm since 2000.
Something that's always struck me about the work you do is, I think for a lot of people, the experience of art is you go to the city and you see things in a museum, and this is obviously very different. This is situating art in a rural area, in farmland. Why is that an important thing for you?
Well, it has become a passion for myself and Jay Salinas, my co-founder and partner. And we used to be from cities, and we used to experience art and music and theater in cities.
And there's nothing wrong with that, I should say. Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that whatsoever, but I see no reason why not to share the wealth in rural areas, but I also don't think it's intrinsically unusual. I mean, the root word of culture means to till the soil. And for generations and generations, and up until recently, dance and music and art have been a key part of fertility and harvest rituals. So I think about it as just kind of a modern approach to an ancient, meaningful ritual.
We'll spend a lot of time on the Farm Art Detour, but one of the manifestations of this has been Fermentation Fest over the years. Could you talk a little bit about the sort of things that Fermentation Fest evolved into over the years?
Well, it began with fermentation fests, but it began alongside an opportunity for Worm Farm to host a traveling Smithsonian exhibit that is only available for small towns, and it's called Museums on Main Street. And the exhibit that we were able to host is called Key Ingredients, America by Food. And so it was within that exhibit that we were able to do our own research about foodways in our area, and fermentation just kind of rose clearly as everyone knows about cheese and beer, but a lot of people don't know about various salamis and sauerkraut and various other fermented products that are really come out of the kind of a German heritage of this area. So we combined the deep dive into local foodways, the Smithsonian exhibit, but mainly what we did was just put it in our own frame of reference for Worm Farm's work. And we insisted that the arts are a key ingredient to a thriving rural community. So it was that moment that we were able to combine the high visibility of the Smithsonian with our two passions, growing food and making the arts available for people with a low threshold for experience. And the detour kind of grew out of that.
And then the fermentation, it's literal, right? In the detour and especially at Fermentation Fest, there's going to be things like a beer and sauerkraut and things that ferment. But there's also that metaphorical part of it, too. Can you talk a little bit about the fermentation as a metaphor for the sort of the art that can happen at events like these?
Exactly. Well, it's the abundance and transformation part of it. So literally, you can milk becomes cheese and grain becomes beer. And there's various ways to make things last. But the fermentation is the action of one kind of scientific process on actual substances in the earth. And so that's what happens with art, too, is that artists respond to opportunities and transform those opportunities into their own work. And so we give them an opportunity during the detour to do that.
We're talking to Donna Neuwirth with the Worm Farm Institute about this year's Farm Art Detour in Sauk County. Donna, let's get into this year's Farm Art Detour. I've been on it this year and in years past, and I got to say, it's hard to put into words exactly what I just saw. A lot of things going on the route. Could you give us the big picture of what we'll see as we move along the route?
Well, it's a 50-mile self-guided drive through scenic working farmlands of southern Sauk County, punctuated by temporary site-responsive art installations in farm fields, roadside poetry, pasture performances, local food stands, and more. And the way that it has evolved is because it's a 10-day, it's over two weekends, so basically a 10-day event. And we are working closely in collaboration with local landowners who tend to be farmers. Sometimes they're absentee farmers, sometimes they're working farmers or landowners. And the art installations are mostly in a hay field after the last crop of hay has been cut. So it's a way that the farmer or the landowner can say yes to this kind of unusual thing that they don't quite know what it's going to be, because they know it's ephemeral and it'll go back to being hay or corn the next year without any interruption.
How have artists responded to this incredibly unique canvas, right? Because there's often these big artworks they end up with, but framed by a farm field here and hay bales there and then bluffs with trees growing on them over there. Is this an exciting canvas for the artists?
Well, I think to the ones that apply for this particular program, yeah, because that's what it's all about. But sometimes it might be more theoretical, and it's only after they get here that they see exactly a couple of things. One, how lost their work can get in the landscape, but also how democratic the experience is, because we don't call it the art farm detour. We call it the farm art detour. So farming gets top billing. And the idea that an artwork might be in a white wall in a cube, it's very, very different. If you're competing with the working landscape and the weather and the traffic, it's a very, very different experience. But I think almost universally, it's been a positive surprise for people just how unusual this opportunity is. And the work belongs to the artist. So, and that's interesting because that can be seen in a variety of ways. One, it's great because the artist can then break it down into pieces and make it into something else or sell it or move it someplace else. All kinds of things happen. But sometimes it's very difficult to take it down and move it. So they might give it to the farmer or the, you know, all kinds of ways of winding up that ephemeral process.
Now, that's the stationary art. There's also performances. Last weekend, I was lucky enough to be there in time for one called the Hay Rake Ballet, which is three pieces of farm equipment with those hay rakes deploying up and down, choreographed, right, synchronized, driving around on the field. And then I don't know if this was planned, but in the crowd, then a line dance broke out during the final number. Talk us through a little bit of that event, because we're not going to see that anywhere else, I don't think.
First of all, we're thrilled about this. We've been thinking about this for several years because hay rakes, the wheeled hay rakes, are such beautiful pieces of equipment that I've just had my eye on for years. Sarah Butler, who was a resident artist with us a couple of years ago, who's a brilliant choreographer. She's currently based in Berlin. We invited her back to help us kind of workshop this idea and see if we could make it happen. We honestly didn't think that we could make it happen so quickly this year. We thought we were going to be playing for a while and then it would happen next year. So this is the first phase of what will be a larger project that we think is amazing. And the most amazing thing about it is how much fun Sarah has had with the various farmers and tractors and hay rakes, negotiating with each of them, because sometimes she can get the driver, but she can't get the rake, and she has to go to another farmer and get a rake. And so she probably has 8 or 10 collaborators on this project already who are thrilled to be a part of it and now think of themselves as performers.
Yeah, because these are the people driving these things. These are clearly the real deal, right? These are farmers who know how to drive and work this equipment. Maybe their first ballet appearance, I'm guessing.
Well, we use the term ballet loosely, but it is choreographed movement. And dance is just movement through space. And Sarah is kind of brilliant in the way she's made this accessible and fun for folks. And the idea of tying it into a physical dance performance with people, that's a work in progress. It started with a line dance. It'll probably go someplace else. We'll see. But so these are pasture performances. And I kind of hesitate to talk about this too much on the radio, because the last thing we want in this 50-mile self-guided drive is for everybody to show up at one place at one time. So
there's multiple performances, though.
But if you don't catch it this time, there will be other opportunities.
Excellent. Donna, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Donna Neuwirth is co-founder and director of the Worm Farm Institute. She developed Fermentation Fest and has served as the artistic director of the Farm Art Detour since it started in 2011. Been talking about this year's Farm Art Detour in Sauk County and how it brings together farmers and artists for a one-of-a-kind experience. It's free and open to the public. It's running now through Monday.
And earlier, we heard sounds from producer Rochelle Wilson's trip to the event last weekend. And thanks to Lee Rayburn for technical direction on that piece. Hey, Rob, do you play pickleball?
I have never played, no.
Well, the kids and I, we play down at Gardner Park courts from time to time. It is hopping. And on a future show, we're going to look at the rise of a massive pickleball complex in Wisconsin and how the sport is growing even without your bangers, Rob.
And we want to hear from you. Do you play? How often? How did you get into the game? Where do you find places to play in your community?
Share your pickleball stories with us. Call or text 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. And Rob, stay out of the kitchen.
But I like to cook. Wait, is that some kind of hipster pickleball slang?
You know.
I do not know. I do not know.
Thank you. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to WPR News.